I got into a car but did not know how to drive. A man who sat behind me gave me instructions. Finally, things were going quite well, and we came to a plaza where there were a number of women standing. The mother of my fiancé received me with great joy. The man was impotent, but had found an instructor in the psychoanalyst. A stone had broken my windshield. I was now open to the storm and rain. Tears came to my eyes. Could I ever reach my destination in this car? The dreamer was a young woman who had lost her virginity and could not get over it. I saw half of a horse lying on the ground. It had only one wing and was trying to arise, but was unable to do so. The patient was a poet who had to earn his daily bread by working as a journalist. I was bitten by an infant. The dreamer was suffering from a psychosexual infantilism. I am locked with my brother in a dark room. He has a large knife in his hand. I am afraid of him. "You will drive me crazy and bring me to the madhouse," I tell him. He laughs with malicious pleasure, replying, "You will always be caught with me. A chain is wrapped around the two of us." I glanced at my legs and noticed for the first time the thick iron chain that bound together my brother and myself. "The brother," comments Dr. Stekel, "was the patient's illness. I am going over a narrow bridge," dreams a 16-year-old girl. "Suddenly it breaks under me and I plunge into the water. An officer dives in after me and brings me, with his strong arms, to the bank. Suddenly it seems to me then that I am a dead body. The officer too looks very pale, like a corpse."
"Naturally," writes Dr. Stekel, "to be dead here means to be alive. She begins to live and the officer lives with her. They die together. This throws a glaring light on the popular fantasy of the double suicide. It should be noted also that this dream includes the well-nigh universal mythological image of the sword bridge, which appears in the romance of Lancelot's rescue of Queen Guinevere from the castle of King Death.
The dreamer is absolutely abandoned and alone in a deep hole of a cellar. The walls of his room keep getting narrower and narrower so that he cannot stir. In this image are combined the ideas of mother womb, imprisonment, cell, and grave. I am dreaming that I have to go through endless corridors. Then I remain for a long time in a little room that looks like the bathing pool in the public baths. They compel me to leave the pool, and I have to pass again through a moist, slippery shaft until I come through a little latticed door into the open. I feel like one newly born, and I think, this means a spiritual rebirth for me through my analysis. There can be no question. The psychological dangers through which earlier generations were guided by the symbols and spiritual exercises of their mythological and religious inheritance, we today, insofar as we are unbelievers, or, if believers, insofar as our inherited beliefs fail to represent the real problems of contemporary life, must face alone, or at best with only tentative, impromptu, and not often very effective guidance. This is our problem as modern, enlightened individuals, for whom all gods and devils have been rationalized out of existence. Nevertheless, in the multitude of myths and legends that have been preserved to us or collected from the ends of the earth, we may yet see delineated something of our still human course. To hear and profit, however, one may have to submit somehow to purgation and surrender. And that is part of our problem. Just how to do that? "Or do ye think that ye shall enter the garden of bliss without such trials as came to those who passed away before you?"
The problem is not new, writes Dr. C. G. Jung, for all ages before us have believed in gods in some form or other. Only an unparalleled impoverishment of symbolism could enable us to rediscover the gods as psychic factors, that is, as archetypes of the unconscious. Heaven has become for us the cosmic space of the physicists and the divine empyrean, a fair memory of things that once were. But the heart glows, and a secret unrest gnaws at the roots of our being.
The oldest recorded account of the passage through the gates of metamorphosis is the Sumerian myth of the goddess Inanna's descent to the netherworld.
From the great above, she set her mind toward the great below. The goddess, from the great above, she set her mind toward the great below. Inanna, from the great above, she set her mind toward the great below. My lady abandoned heaven, abandoned earth, to the netherworld she descended. Inanna abandoned heaven, abandoned earth, to the netherworld she descended. Abandoned lordship, abandoned ladyship, to the netherworld she descended.
She adorned herself with her queenly robes and jewels. 7 divine decrees she fastened at her belt. She was ready to enter the land of no return, the netherworld of death and darkness, governed by her enemy and sister goddess, Ereshkigal. In fear, lest her sister should put her to death, Inanna instructed Ninshubur, her messenger, to go to heaven and set up a hue and cry for her in the assembly hall of the gods, if after 3 days she should have failed to return. Inanna descended. She approached the temple made of lapis lazuli, and at the gate was met by the chief gatekeeper, who demanded to know who she was and why she had come. "I am the Queen of Heaven, the place where the sun rises," she replied. "If thou art the Queen of Heaven," he said, "the place where the sun rises, why, pray, hast thou come to the land of no return? On the road whose traveler returns not, how has thy heart led thee?" Inanna declared that she had come to attend the funeral rites of her sister's husband, the Lord Gugulana, whereupon Neti, the gatekeeper, bid her stay until he should report to Ereshkigal. Neti was instructed to open to the Queen of Heaven the 7 gates, but to abide by the custom and remove at each portal a part of her clothing.
To the pure Inanna he says, "Come, Inanna, enter." Upon her entering the first gate, the shugura, the crown of the plane of her head, was removed. "What, pray, is this? Extraordinarily, O Inanna, have the decrees of the netherworld been perfected. O Inanna, do not question the rites of the netherworld." Upon her entering the second gate, the rod of lapis lazuli was removed. "What, pray, is this? Extraordinarily, O Inanna, have the decrees of the netherworld been perfected. O Inanna, do not question the rites of the netherworld." Upon her entering the third gate, the small lapis lazuli stones of her neck were removed. "What, pray, is this? Extraordinarily, O Inanna, have the decrees of the netherworld been perfected. O Inanna, do not question the rites of the netherworld." Upon her entering the fourth gate, the sparkling stones of her breast were removed. "What, pray, is this? Extraordinarily, O Inanna, have the decrees of the netherworld been perfected. O Inanna, do not question the rites of the netherworld." Upon her entering the fifth gate, the gold ring of her hand was removed. "What, pray, is this? Extraordinarily, O Inanna, have the decrees of the netherworld been perfected. O Inanna, do not question the rites of the netherworld." Upon her entering the sixth gate, the breastplate of her breast was removed. "What, pray, is this? Extraordinarily, O Inanna, Have the decrees of the netherworld been perfected? O Inanna, do not question the rites of the netherworld. Upon her entering the seventh gate, all the garments of ladyship of her body were removed. What prey is this? Extraordinarily, O Inanna, have the decrees of the netherworld been perfected? O Inanna, do not question the rites of the netherworld.
Naked, she was brought before the throne. She bowed low. The seven judges of the netherworld, the Anunnaki, sat before the throne of Ereshkigal, and they fastened their eyes upon Inanna, the eyes of death.
At their word, the word which tortures the spirit, the sick woman was turned into a corpse. The corpse was hung from a stake.
Inanna and Ereshkigal, the two sisters, light and dark respectively, together represent, according to the antique manner of symbolization, the one goddess in two aspects, and their confrontation epitomizes the whole sense of the difficult road of trials. The hero, whether god or goddess, man or woman, the figure in a myth or the dreamer of a dream, discovers and assimilates his opposite, his own unsuspected self, either by swallowing it or by being swallowed. One by one, the resistances are broken. He must put aside his pride, his virtue, beauty, and life, and bow or submit to the absolutely intolerable. Then he finds that he and his opposite are not of differing species, but one flesh. Or, as James Joyce has phrased it, equals of opposites evolved by a one same power of nature or of spirit, as the sole condition and means of its him and her manifestation, and polarized for reunion by the symphysis of their antipathies. The ordeal is a deepening of the problem of the first threshold, and the question is still in balance. Can the ego put itself to death? For many-headed is this surrounding hydra. One head cut off, two more appear, unless the right caustic is applied to the mutilated stump. The original departure into the land of trials represented only the beginning of the long and really perilous path of initiatory conquests and moments of illumination. Dragons have now to be slain, and surprising barriers passed, again, again, and again. Meanwhile, there will be a multitude of preliminary victories, unretainable ecstasies, and momentary glimpses of the wonderful land.